Imagine a platform where some of Britain's biggest stars have the opportunity to reflect and celebrate their biggest professional accomplishments in a lovely, relaxed, chatty space. Since 2016, Josh Barry's Beyond the Title has celebrated the great and good of entertainment, from showbiz legends to rising stars and everyone in between, who have each provided an insight into their remarkable careers in the public eye. So join Josh and the team as another significant figure in entertainment shares their unique anecdotes and stories exclusively on Beyond the Title.
One of the most recognisable voices on BBC Radio, writer and broadcaster Zoe Ball, was announced as the new Radio 2 breakfast show host and took over from Chris Evans in January 2019. This was just one of the highlights in a career that has seen her become one of Britain's most prolific presenters in a career spanning three decades. Born into the world of entertainment, thanks to her father Johnny, Zoe began her television career as a runner at Granada Television and researcher for The Cool Cube on BSkyB, before securing a presenting role on the BBC children's series Fully Booked alongside Vernon Kay. In 1996, she united with the talents of Jamie Theakston for the second incarnation of the Saturday morning juggernaut Live and Kicking, before becoming the first female to inherit the infamous Radio 1 breakfast show in 1997 and helped to spearhead the Ledette culture of the late 90s. Appearing in the third series of the heavyweight Strictly Come Dancing in 2005, partnered by Ian Waite, she came third, which proved to be the start of a long association with the series that climaxed in her presenting the sister show It Takes Two for 9 years until 2020. I caught up with one of the most prolific broadcasters of her generation to talk father's fame and her recollections on an unparalleled career in broadcasting. Ladies and gentlemen, Miss Zoe Ball.
Welcome to Beyond the Title. Normally I'd start with an easy question to relax my subject, but we're recording this podcast just 4 days after the legendary Ken Bruce left Radio 2, so I felt it wouldn't be right if we didn't touch upon the popmaster himself. How significant was he to the Radio 2 family, and what effect will his departure from Radio 2 have on radio as a whole, and what's his legacy?
Well, now there's a question. Ken, what's a gent? For me, I grew up listening to Radio 2, and most people, you know, at my age were listening to Capital or Radio 1. But Terry Wogan was in our household, and Ken. And they're kind of the voices of our childhood, you know. So it was, so to then work with him or alongside him many years later, and I was entrusted with Popmaster rather disastrously. No one could ever do Popmaster as well as Ken. He's just the master. But he'd been such a great friend to me. He'd been so supportive. When I started at Radio 2, there was Ken and Alan Boyd, who used to produce Terry, Lynn Bowles, who is obviously legendary, and I really miss her there as well, and Alan Dedicote. There was a real gang, and they were so kind of the soul of Radio 2, and they very much took me under their wing. Ken obviously was one of them. We used to go to the pub straight after Ken's show on a Friday, and they would tell me the most amazing stories about that place. So Ken very much took me under his wing quite early on. So we've been a great friend. So you've got both sides then. You're a listener who loves his voice, love how witty and clever and sharp he was. My handovers with him were often my favourite, because you would never know where he would go with things, but he always came back with a gag. So I'm like the listeners, you know, gutted that he's left, and wishing him so much love for his new adventures. But you can't blame him for wanting a change of scenery after 31 years in the mid-morning slot on Radio 2. So new adventures lie ahead for him, but I will miss him as a friend and as a broadcaster. And big shoes to fill. But Vernon is very tall, has very big feet, and is also great fun. And I think he will do that show, you know, justice. He's going to be great fun. I'm looking forward to our handovers, actually. But, yeah. And the other thing is, Ken's only down the road. So hopefully we'll get to see him soon. We haven't had his send-off party yet. But don't tell him, but I've ordered about 30 Ken Bruce masks. So as he walks into the party, he'll be faced with a lot of him looking back. There's only love for Ken wherever you go, you know. And even my own dad, you know, my family are all very much like, what are we going to do without Ken? But you know, he is still there, and he will be on the air, just in a different place.
As a broadcaster, you're in an elite group with people like Lisa Tarbuck, Emily Atack, and Roman Kemp, who were born into the world of entertainment and found themselves following in the footsteps of a parent. How old were you when you realised that your dad didn't have a normal job, and how did this ignited your passion for broadcasting?
I think the first time I realised my dad didn't have a normal job was when I was found saying, I've got two daddies, to someone, because I would see him on Play School and then see him in the room. And apparently also I was overheard saying, my daddy goes this big and climbs inside my television. So obviously it took a bit of explaining as a child. But to us, it was kind of just his job that he did. And the time we would really notice as kids was when we were out and about and people would come bounding up to him because he was so loved. And he was always fab with people when they would come up and talk to him about how something was made or da 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 da. So he would just engage with everybody. And obviously, as you get older, you become slightly more embarrassed of your parents and what they do. I'm going through that delight now with my teenage daughter. And I love to embarrass her whenever I can. So out and about, we'd often see. But Dad would do these things. So when I started dating, quite sort of, you know, teen years, he would do this thing if ever boys came around, ding dong, and he'd open the door and he'd either dress up or go into character, or he'd play tricks on me and say, oh, you're Phil, are you the decorator? Oh, no, hang on, you're the carpenter. Oh, no, that was Wednesday. He'd be like, Dad, no. So he would obviously, you know, embarrass us wherever he could. But I was always slightly awkward about watching him on telly. I'd get slightly embarrassed in the teen years. But it was great fun because he would take us to Wood Lane, to BBC Television Centre. And that, for me as a child, to then see the two Ronnies or the guys who did Match of the Day or, you know, Roy Castle. We'd often go out and we'd see Roy Castle. But as a child, that place to me was like a wonderland. So it was pretty exciting. And I guess, really, that's when the love affair with telly started for me, I guess.
I just did a book with your dad.
Josh has just done a podcast with your dad about TV Centre.
Do you know the thing now, Josh? You go there and it's been turned into like wine bars and flats, and all the people in there are really young. And I stood in the lobby looking at the floor because there's a few traces of what it used to be. And obviously Lorraine is there and, you know, this morning and stuff like that. But I was like, no, you can't turn those studios into a bar. Does nobody know what happened in this building? So it's quite strange. I miss that place, the donut. And Roy Castle would always be trying to break a world record out there or something. Blue Peter would be shooting and you'd see Alan Hansen in the corridor. It was such a great place. I'm really grateful that I got to do children's telly there and Live and Kicking and all the shows we did there for all those years before it, you know, changed hands.
There's obviously early archive footage of you and your brother on Swap Shop when your dad was making a guest appearance. Do you remember a lot about that show? And what was your dad's reaction to you following in his footsteps?
I kind of loved going into the Saturday mornings when Dad was on. But I remember that day very well because I'd got to the awkward age of not really wanting to be on camera because I had a really bad boyish haircut and was, you know, horribly embarrassed by everything. And then my brother Dan and I are there and somebody, I think they fall off the seating right along from us. And I can't remember who was on. It was someone like Duran Duran. It was either Tears for Fears or Duran Duran. So going back to school, I was like, oh, we were in the studio and we saw. Little did I know that clip would come back many years later to haunt both Dan and. But I remember distinctly going, my dad would write at night. He would write on an old typewriter, and his office was next to my bedroom. And I always found it quite a comforting sound, my dad, you know, writing his scripts late into the night on his typewriter. And I remember I'd given it a bit of thought that I'd always sort of wanted to do something in his sort of field. And one night I went in to see him quite late, and I was like, Dad, I think I want to be a TV presenter. And I slightly was worried that he might go, what? That's a proper job. But he was so excited for me, and very much like, and also the other thing with Dad and my grandparents, everyone worked really, really hard. So it was never a, I can open a door for you. You know, I had to go and study, and then I went and worked as a runner and kind of worked my way up. And it's a really great way to do it as well, because you learn about all the different, you know, jobs within television or radio. And then you get to see what you really want to do. It's definitely what I would advise anyone who is interested in getting into radio and television themselves, is to start as a runner. So I had to do that. But he was really supportive, you know, and he has been over the years of me and everything my brothers have done as well. So, yeah, I still get really nervous if he comes on my show, if he comes in the studio, or if he comes when he used to come to It Takes Two, I'd be like, oh, I'm so nervous. Oh, my dad's in. Because I just want to make him proud, you know.
The start of your career coincided with the popularisation of Rupert Murdoch's Be Sky B, which was heralded as a revolution in British TV. You secured a researcher role on the Sky TV show Cool Cube. How did satellite TV was perceived by the majority of Britain at what was still the early stages of its development?
This is amazing research, can I say. My team on The Breakfast Show would be very impressed with this deep dive. So Cool Cube was such a fun programme on a Saturday morning. Michaela Strachan presented it, Mark Curry, Simon Day, a really brilliant lass called Violet Berlin. But we used to do competitions. And when this chap from Withenshaw won the competition 4 or 5 weeks in a row, and someone on the production team rang to say, you've won a bike, you know, thinking he was the dad of the child who'd ended the competition, and we realised that he was a grown man. We had quite a small viewership at that point, and that sort of demonstrated perfectly how few people were watching it, I think. Yeah, when you think back then, there really were only, you know, BBC and ITV, and I guess Channel 4 came along at some point around that time. But yeah, back in the day, Be Sky B, not many people were watching at all. It's been really lovely over the years to see Michaela and Mark, you know, and we all sort of fondly remember, because we had so much fun working on it, and it was made at Granada Studios. We had Take That on the show when they were, you know, mere whippersnappers, way before they really made it. And they were so lovely, and they're still as lovely now as they were back then. So, and I've seen sort of people who used to work on the Granada Studios tour. There's a really lovely comedian called Steve Royal, and he used to work on the tour, and we get on really well. And years later, he's on Britain's Got Talent, and he does all the pantos up in Manchester, and he's an absolute superstar. So it's quite funny. And Russell T. Davis worked at Granada around the same time, and we have mutual friends. And I remember meeting Russell, and I was so naive and knew nothing then. I was just a kid. And, you know, I look at Russell's career years later, and I think, hey, you know what? We all did all right, actually. I mean, Russell is a god.
You then landed a presenting role on the BBC Two children's entertainment series Fully Booked, alongside fellow Future Broadcasting royalty. They say children's programming is like the University of Television, but how did this experience help you cultivate your own broadcasting style?
Do you know what? The great thing about kids' TV is that, you know, whoever takes you on, you're taken on quite, you know, you haven't got a huge amount of skills when you first start, but it's live TV. So you learn on the job, and you have a really supportive team around you. And also it's mayhem and quite fun. I mean, Saturday morning telly, or, you know, I used to read the birthday cards. I used to introduce the Coddington Peas and read the birthday cards to Lily, who was 5, and you'd, you know, pull up, you know, Thomas the Tank Engine or whoever it was, and the picture would be underneath. So you kind of learn your skill on the job, and it's such good fun. I think that's, you know, those days I treasure so greatly, because I was a bit overwhelmed at the beginning because you're thinking, I don't really know what I'm doing here. How's this going to go? And there was a great guy called Paul Smith, who actually was also, he was the head of televisions, but he was also Gordon the Gopher. So he would operate Gordon the Gopher and then be working out your schedule and what you were doing. And he took a real chance on me and many other people. You know, he employed Andy Peters and Philippa Forrester and Toby Anstis, and Chris Jarvis. A load of us came through under Paul, and obviously Philip Schofield. So he's really proud. But I think that is priceless training, doing live telly. And the good thing is, with the kids and the adults, you could kind of mess it up within reason and be forgiven. and it did teach me a lot of great skills, you know.
When we interviewed Sarah Green about a week ago, she wouldn't tell us who was underneath Gordon the Gopher.
Did she not? You talked to Sarah Green. See, Sarah Green was my hero, you know. She did what I really wanted to do, and I so looked up to her. And such a lovely lady, such an amazing lady, you know. And all the girls like that, me, it was Sally James from Tiz Was. You're probably too young to remember her, you two. And then Sarah, and also just watching people like Valerie Singleton and Leslie Judd on Blue Peter. It was... you know, quite amazing ladies who, you know, even now I still get excited just the mention of Sarah Green. Sarah Green. And it's quite nice because the younger guys come through. So I remember meeting Fern Cotton for the first time, and she was saying, oh, I kind of want to do what you do. And then I look at her now, and she to me is, I'm like, Fern, I'm so proud of her. You know, I didn't teach her anything, but it's a nice gang to be part of.
In 1996, you were chosen to become one half of the presenting team on the New Look Live and Kicking alongside Jamie Theakston. How daunting was it to attempt to emulate the success of Emma Forbes and Andy Peters? And in your opinion, how did Live and Kicking reflect the wants and desires of the British teenager demographic?
Well, it was only fun, that show. And I remember I tested out the wonderful Chris, who took us on, who took Jamie and I on. I screen tested with a few different people, but there was just this instant chemistry with Jamie. He was great fun. He was very handsome and dashing, and we knew we were going to have a good time. So, and the team, I still see some of the camera guys from that show, all the people who produced it. Dan Baldwin, who's Mr. Holly Willoughby, he worked on that show. I think at the time he must have been about 12 because he's still only 30 something. Everyone who worked on it has gone on and done great stuff. And it was so much fun, you know, to have Will Smith in the studio or Betty Boothroyd. When she passed away the other day, I was remembering Betty Boothroyd being in the hot seat. And, you know, it's the first time I kind of met Ronan and the gang from Boyzone, because they were sort of coming up at a sort of similar time as us. So, and it was funny and silly. We had Trevor and Simon, we had the Leprechauns, we had the guys, Men in Trousers. And you never knew what was going to happen. I think there was one time when I was wrestled to the ground by some American wrestler. And the next minute, you know, my dad would come out of something dressed as a bear. Mr. Blobby would terrorize everybody. But it was great fun. And over the years, I remember seeing Daniel Radcliffe, and he'd been one of the kids and had asked a question of one of the guests. One of the in-betweeners had been on Grab It Rabbit, and Cara Toynton was in the audience and asked a question of someone. So it was a real joyous team to be part of. And we were really lucky that it went down well, and we had, you know, a couple of fantastic years on that show. And I think the beauty of Saturday morning telly was the sort of layers of it. So you'd have the stuff for the kids, and you'd stuff for the little ones. So you'd have the Rugrats, and then you'd have it'd be slightly racier. But then you also had the humour that was always quite family friendly, but there was always that slight layer from the crew would be laughing at things that maybe the mums and dads would get. And I try to explain to my kids now how much fun Saturday morning telly was and what a fun job and real privilege to be part of it. And they're like, what? What was this show? I tried to show them on VHS. They're not that interested. But some of the best days of my life working on that show.
Just a year later, you made history when you were unveiled as the first female to inherit the legendary Radio 1 breakfast show as part of Matthew Bannister's successful revolution of the network. At the height of the Britpop era, how important was it for you to reflect and celebrate the pop culture landmarks that were occurring at the time? And what were your thoughts on the whole Ladette culture?
Well, that's what they said to me. They said, Zoe, we want you to go out and come back in of a morning and tell us what's going on out and about. I took that quite literally. And was out quite a lot. And Scott Mills and I still have a very special relationship because Scott would often have to step in if I was late or didn't make the show. But in music, it was such an electric time with Britpop and dance music. You know, you had acts like Fatboy Slim, obviously, and Chemical Brothers, and you had Oasis and Travis, and it was just such an exciting time. It was very rock and roll, that era. To be honest with you, I wasn't very rock and roll at all. I think that was part of the thing. I was like, quick, pretend to be really rock and roll. And I took that perhaps a bit too far. But it really was such an exciting time to be involved in broadcasting. Yeah, it was a tad hit and miss occasionally on our show. We used to do a feature called Shop 'em or Drop 'em, where someone would have to tell some salacious gossip about someone they'd worked with or drop their trousers. I mean, that is not the kind of thing that you would be doing on the radio these days. I remember Samuel L. Jackson dropped his trousers and we were all like, Mariah Carey was very classy and she just dropped the shoulder of her cardigan, right? Which, you know, that was the way to do it. So you never really knew what was gonna happen. And the Ladette thing, to be honest with you, at the time, I didn't really think about it too much, I guess, in a way, because I was just a bit young. But on reflection, you look back and think, yeah, it was sort of a label given to us all, you know, girls who went out and had fun. And then we were all kind of put into this sort of labeled thing of, oh yeah, they're Ladettes and they're raucous. And then in a way you had the sort of, it was sort of a kind of myth that perpetuated itself in a way, in that you kind of almost had to live up to the expectations. And I hated doing photo shoots, and they'd make you do photo shoots for magazines where I would always feel slightly uncomfortable. And if you ever look back at the pictures, I'm always slightly like, what? I don't know what to do. I don't know how to do this stuff. And I think I was reading Sophie Ellis Bextor's book, and it kind of made me a little bit sad, because she was growing up during the Ladette era, and she was saying as a young woman how it was sort of like, this is how you kind of were expected to be, and she didn't feel like she was that way. And I suddenly saw it in a whole different perspective of like, oh no, you know, I wouldn't have wanted young women to feel like they had to behave like that. So yeah, the word Ladette now, I mean, I can think of it and laugh, but I guess had I been a bit more savvy at that age, I might have kicked back from that label slightly. But yeah, but they were good times, and I can almost remember them now quite fondly.
Josh actually came to Radio 1.
In 1996.
And he sat in on the breakfast show with Chris Evans.
Oh, wow. Well, he was the master, you know. Everybody learned from Chris. Because he was a brilliant producer. He was great on air and he was very encouraging. I used to work with him on The Big Breakfast. And when I left to go and do my first job presenting, he got me in the bathroom with Zig and Zag. Do you remember that Zig and Zag used to do the interviews in the bathroom? Yeah. And Chris was like, come on, this is Zoe. She works on the show and she's going off to do kids TV. And he's always been a big supporter, which is great. He's the ultimate. He's an amazing broadcaster. He's very good.
But
Do you think at the time BBC was a bit concerned about having someone who was a bit too raucous?
Are you talking about Chris or me?
Like following in the footsteps of Chris Evans.
Yes, I've done that a couple of times, haven't I now? I must stop making a habit of it. He leaves very big shoes to fill, does Chris. But, you know, he sets a great example. He really does. And he's always been, he has been quite supportive. I think in the beginning, especially when I started at Radio 1, I was a bit overwhelmed by what was expected of me a little bit. And the newspapers played on that quite wonderfully. And because I was a tad naive, I got a little bit upset about them kind of being like, well, Zoe says this and Chris says that. And, da, 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 da. And at the end of Live and Kicking one Saturday, I got a phone call. Well, I got in my ear, I heard a message from the gallery saying, Zoe, you've got a caller. Can you just come to the gallery to take this call? And I went in and it was Chris Evans. He went, right, what time do you get off work? I said, 12:15. He said, I'll pick you up outside. So I go out at 12:15 and there he is in his big posh car. And he said, come on, we're going to go for a drink. And he just explained to me a little bit about, he's like, look, you know what? No press. Don't worry about the press. It's all fun and games and a bit of competitiveness. And he kind of taught me quite a lot about what the business was about, in a way. He also asked me to marry him, but I said no, thanks. But I think he was always about, you know, big gestures and fun things. And he was great fun, and I really appreciate that he's always been a big supporter. It was even scarier taking over from him at Radio 2. Like, goodness me. But by that point, I was a little, I guess I've been doing it a little bit longer and a bit wiser to it all than back in the day. But he has taught me a lot, yeah.
I've got some lyrics from Suede's top 10 hit, She's in Fashion. And I just want to solve the mystery behind the identity of the person in question. She's the face on the radio, she's the body on the morning show, and she's there shaking it out on the scene, and she's the colour of a magazine. Do you think this is about you?
Well, I do know that it's not about me, because I think Brett from Suede, I don't know whether Brett told me or I heard Brett in an interview just saying, I think it was about a type of woman in that era. So it's not directly about me, because that bit you'd be like quite flattered. But then later on it says, isn't it, she's the taste of gasoline or something or other. But I still people, in fact, Jo Wiley said the other day, she said, is this all about you? I'm like, no, it's not about me. I think it was about a particular type of woman, perhaps Ladettes maybe, or women, you know, who were trying to hold their own in that time. It's a brilliant song, though. And the strings on it are excellent. And it's great to see Suede doing well again now. I had to interview them quite a lot, and I was always such a big fan. I just properly fall apart every time I had to interview Brett, because they were so cool. I just turn up and try to be cool. And by trying to be cool would be so desperately uncool. So yeah, I even to this day, I still get a bit silly when I see the boys from Suede because they're such heroes of mine.
As a broadcaster, how important is it to attempt to capture, celebrate and echo the zeitgeist of the time?
Well, I think that's the key. I think you're being that. I think those things you have to remember as a broadcaster is you're one listener or you're one viewer, because that's who you're talking to. So it's the one, when you're doing Kids TV, it was always the one kid who sat at home watching. And if you can engage with that one person. And I think especially when we started doing the breakfast show and then it was the pandemic. It wasn't long after we'd started that the pandemic came. And I remember panicking a little bit, thinking, I'm not quite sure how we're going to do this. And I used to talk to Wrighty quite a lot, lovely Steve. It's like, well, you know, what do we do in this situation? And our job was to keep people company. And more people were being isolated and on their own. And it was very much being a friend, you know, on the radio. And the fact that I often will listen to the radio day or night and be on your own. And I always feel like Mark Ratcliffe or Joe Wiley, they are my friends, you know, Lisa Tarbuck, who I love and adore. Those voices are so comforting. Bob Harris, you know, these voices that we've grown up with. So very much during the pandemic, it was sort of learning to take the show down, perhaps, and being a bit more reflective about what people were going through, trying to be understanding. And I hope that's something that we still do with our show, is that we try to give people some joy and entertainment if that's what they're needing. But also, you know, broadcasting after Her Majesty died, it's learning to, what do the listeners need from you? Do they need music? Do they need chat? Do they need to share their messages and their thoughts, which often they do? Or sometimes do they just want to have fun and dance and sing or be distracted from the weather being terrible or whatever? So it's sort of learning to follow your listeners. And the wonderful thing with being able to communicate so easily with text and WhatsApp, we can reflect what our listeners are going through. And so, you know, when a legend in music has passed away, people can share their messages or their thoughts. And when, you know, there's something fabulous like Grimsby Town FC doing so brilliantly the other night in the footy, we were able to, you know, properly share in that love, because I think there's so many people who are like, this is so brilliant to see after so long. So it's just learning to kind of follow your listeners like that. Don't always get it right, but we do try to. And I think it's just being sensitive, you know, and being a mom and being someone who's lost people or gone through tricky times, which we all have in our lives, it helps you sort of feel like you can understand what people are going through sometimes. So if you need us to be silly and daft, hopefully we bring that. And if you need us to be a bit more sensitive and reflective, hopefully we can do that too.
So if in 30 years people will listen back to you in lockdown, what do you think they'd understand about what was going on?
Oh my goodness me. Yes, gosh. Will they ever listen back? I don't think they'd ever want to listen to that time again. I don't think I'm being put in the time capsule, Josh. I think if they go back, they'll probably listen to Terry's old shows because he was so brilliant. Well, I guess they would learn that, you know, people went through a really, really tough time. It was just something we, in our lifetime, we'd never lived through. You know, we're too young to have remembered the war or to imagine, you know, any times that were really troubling. many of my family lived through terrible strikes or recession or whatever, but it was like something none of us had ever known before. So, you know, and so frightening as well, you know, frightening for us. We were all worried about our parents. We were worried about our loved ones. We were worried about our friends who worked in the NHS, and we just didn't know what was coming. So it, for all of us, you know, we were in it together. And hopefully, if you listen back, you'd feel the sense of community. I hope that we try to kind of bring each other, because it's very much a community, the radio, you know, and it does feel like a Radio 2 family. And I'm really touched sometimes when they can, you know, you might have a wonky week or a show, you know, I mean, the 5 shows a week, there are days where you think, oh, goodness me, what am I talking about? Also, I'm menopausal, so I forget people's names and start talking utter nonsense. But sometimes you'll just get one or two messages. It might be on socials, it might have come through the email, from someone who's just going through a bit of a time themselves, and something we've played or something we've discussed has just brought some comfort. It might be Chesney Hawkes. I am the one and only. It could be a moment on pause for thought. It could be us reflecting on something daft. But if that has provided some comfort to someone, then it just makes you feel like, okay, we're doing the right thing, you know. So hopefully, yeah, if someone listened back, they would pick up on the feel, hopefully, of what a nation was going through. They might be better off listening to Radio 4 news reports, though, however, if they really wanted to learn about me.
Jumping back a bit in time, if you had to pick one moment which summed up Britpop, what would that be?
Oh, Britpop. I think for me, Britpop will have been the Brits, perhaps. I think Liam and Noel at the Brits in various states of daftness, going to see them, you know, at Nebworth. Moments like that were huge, because they were the biggest band in the world, you know, and not the world, maybe. Noel would probably say that. But it was such rock and roll. Also, I remember once having lunch with Jamie Theakston and Chris, our boss, from Live and Kicking, in a hotel in West London somewhere, and Liam was sat at the bar a few along from us, and he was going through a tough time with Patsy Kensit, and he'd had a few drinks, and we ended up having some drinks with him, and he was so dashing and handsome and such a Britpop hero, and he was such a sweetheart. He was obviously going through quite a tough time in his marriage. I remember Jamie and I like, my God, I had to interview them once as well, and someone dug the interview up, and I don't know what I'm wearing, a worst outfit. I'm wearing some kind of cap and a pair of short shorts, and I'm clearly trying to be very cool and failing miserably. But they are lovely boys. And do you know what? It's so great. I see them now. They come on the show now. And Liam, so charming and lovely, and a dad, and bringing up his kids and appreciating, you know, the second time around. And who knows? Maybe they will finally make up and reform and give us those concerts, which we also desperately want to see.
In 2005, you were unveiled amongst the lineup for the third series of Strictly Come Dancing, eventually coming third with your partner Ian Waite. What reservations did you have about doing it? And as a broadcaster, how difficult was it to merely be a contestant rather than the one presenting?
It, you know what, it was, because it wasn't a huge show back in the day, but I loved the idea of learning a skill. And my nana and granddad always danced, you know, back in the day. That's, you know, everybody socialized, everybody would go dancing together, so I thought it'd be such a lovely thing to do. And I had met Ian Waite very briefly on another show and adored him, and after I met Ian I thought, oh, hang on, if I could dance with him, I'd love to do this. And do you know what, it changed a lot of people's perception of me, because I was seen as being a bit, you know, lewd and loud and a ladette, by especially a certain generation. And I was taught to dance gracefully as I could, and wear beautiful dresses, which was so a world away from everything I'd done before, and learn the foxtrot, which my nana and granddad would dance. And I guess it brought me to a different generation, and some people were like, oh, hang on a minute. She's a lady underneath all of that. So it was really, and then it ended up bringing me 10 years of doing It Takes Two with alongside Ian, and all the fabulous dancers, and being able to help other celebs through it when they're going through it, going, I know exactly how this is, and that dance is particularly hellish. So I'm so grateful that I had the chance to do it. I wish I could do it again. I wish I could wipe people's memories and learn to do it again. But although these days, when we did it, we did 10 dances and it was quite straightforward. These days they do backflips. They do all sorts and they work so hard. But it never fails to sort of wow me every year, the talent and how people can start with such little dance knowledge and go on like Hamza, someone like Hamza this year. Yeah, just phenomenal. And Tony Adams, who was my personal favourite, I have to say. He was great.
This led you to host the 2-hour dancing extravaganza in 2005 from Trafalgar Square. What were your memories of working with the legendary Bruce Forsyth?
He was so adorable, but we had the most disastrous day because we had possibly 300 dancers gathered in the square, and you had tap dancers, you had the cast of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, there were ballroom dancers, there were hula dancers, and about 20 minutes before we went on air, the skies went black and the rain fell and it did not stop. So all the dancers were slipping over the stage and it was just chaos. Cameras couldn't see because the rain was coming down. My makeup was running. Everybody was running left, right and centre. It was absolute carnage. Goodness knows how it appeared. I remember the ending. We almost fell off the air. But Bruce was such a gentleman, and there's no one like him. And I have this lovely memory of when I was performing on Strictly, my Nana came to watch the show, and it wasn't long before we lost my Nana, actually. And Bruce, before the show started, the band would play and he'd sing a song. And so the audience would come in and they'd get this fabulous variety show, and he'd do his soft shoe shuffle. And he asked my Nana up to dance. So Bruce Forsyth danced with my Nana. And it was one of the happiest days for her. And so ever since that moment, he's a very, very special man and stays very much in our hearts. They don't make him like that anymore.
Oh, you would.
Josh would have loved to have interviewed him.
Oh, I know. But his stories, honestly, all his stories about working with Jimmy Tarbuck and the gang. You need to interview Jimmy. Have you interviewed Jimmy yet?
He knows Jimmy well.
Oh, well, there you go. There you go. So you know Lisa then? Do you know Lisa as well?
He's trying to get her for an interview.
She's the funniest lady on the radio, isn't she? I just adore her. She plays music as well.
Josh actually went to his golf club to interview him. There's a funny story about the BBC.
We were waiting for you to get a golf.
They were waiting for him to get off the golf course, and the BBC were also waiting to interview him.
Oh, So, my friend,
as soon as he came off the golf course, he saw Josh and told the BBC they'd have to wait.
Timmy.
Carrying on, in 2011, you replaced the great Claudia Winkleman for the sister show It Takes Two. In the era of the sister show, what are the advantages and disadvantages of having the show five nights a week as opposed to a prologue to the main Saturday night extravaganza?
Well, I think the good part is that you, very much with It Takes Two, we got to be the silly sister show. But, you know, so it was, to be honest with you, It Takes Two reminded me very much of Live and Kicking days. Slightly anarchic, the crew would all get involved, and it was quite fun. And I think the celebs and the dancers would really enjoy coming to do it because they were on a very tight schedule, it's very pressured. And when they're doing the Saturday night show, everything is hanging on that one performance that they do. Whereas in the week, they'd get to us, they'd have a glass of wine or a gin and tonic, and then they'd come in and we'd all have a bit of a giggle and take the mickey slightly and dance around and do, you know, silly routines and whatever. So it was always really fun. And I remember Kevin Clifton and Ali Ash and Karen and the gang would say how much fun it was just to come and do It Takes Two. So sometimes those shows, when you look at Ryland doing Big Brother's Little Brother and all those sorts of shows, and Tom Allen doing the show for The Apprentice and for Bake Off, those shows, I think you get to be a bit naughtier and a bit silly and a bit daft. Mm. So, yeah, it was such a treat to do. I miss it, but it's difficult in the morning and the evening. But I do miss it, but I do tune in. But again, I think that show and Live and Kicking were my favourite telly projects. Definitely. Live telly is the best.
Yeah. In January 2019, history repeated itself when you replaced Chris Evans on the Radio 2 breakfast show. How daunting was it to inherit a time slot which had been so synonymous with the late great Sir Terry Wogan? And what was the process you took to put your own stamp on the show?
I think doing a lot of breathing in and breathing out, trying desperately hard not to panic, and working with a really good team. And the first thing was to bed in, I think, and wait for the nerves to settle. I remember the first link, my lip was just sticking to my teeth. I thought, I'm never going to get this sentence out. So, yeah, what we wanted to do was try and find our own way and give everybody a little bit of what they need, you know. So we still have the QILs coming on Wednesday. It's like everybody wants to learn something. You want the listeners to have a chance to choose the tunes, and also you want reaction from the listeners at that time of day. So it took a little while. We sort of figured out, we tried some things and then we tried other things, then we had the pandemic. But I think now we found our own identity, and we've got a lovely gang working on it. It's impossible to ever hit the heady heights of Sir Terry, who was the greatest breakfast broadcaster we've ever had. And I don't think anyone will, because of his wonderful humour. Janet and John, the Janet and John stories on the breakfast show with Terry are still, you know, they're just the greatest. And also, there are still songs that I'll hear on the radio that can make me emotional thinking of Terry. I heard Heartbreaker this morning, Heartbreaker, Dionne Warwick. He used to play that all the time. In fact, when I was at school, he used to play this song by Charlene called I've Never Been to Me. And I sang it in the school assembly. And when you listen to the lyrics now, it's all about I took the hand of a preacher man and we made love in the sun. It's not really what a 10-year-old should be singing in the school assembly. But I love that song because Terry played it every day. And again, following on from Chris, and Chris packed that show with so much gold, you know, and he'd do on this day and all, you know, all these great things he would do and top tenuous. And you'd come up with all these ideas and go, oh, we could do this. Oh, no, that's exactly the feature he used to do. Oh, we can do this. Ah, no, that's what Chris did so well. So you've got to find other ways of entertaining the crowd and the team. We now do a thing called the 7:33, and it's the most popular part of our show, which we have a theme and we play three tracks at 7:33 and the listeners suggest them. And now the listeners have got into guessing what the tracks will be and scoring themselves points at the quiz on Thursday, which is quite basic and quite straightforward, that Jay introduced to us during lockdown because he would do these quizzes for people online, is again hugely popular. And I love, Chris started it, you know, the Fridays with a huge gang in. And this week we've got three fabulous country stars, Thomas Rhett, Breland and Lainey Wilson. And a couple of weeks ago we had Richard E. Grant with Helena Bonham Carter talking about the first film they ever made together. We've been on the air for 2 minutes with them in the studio, and Richard had said, yes, that film we made together where I had to poke you in the woods. And she said something about him. Yes, and you immediately got a hard on. I was like, family radio. You know, John Bishop was sat there looking at me going, I can't believe this is happening. So you do have some opportunities for gold in there. You really do. It's a true privilege to do that show. I'll stay as long as they want me.
Looking back at your career, what's your proudest achievement?
Well, I mean, in my career, I guess being able to do Radio 1 and Radio 2 breakfast shows, pretty special. Live and Kicking, I think all the kids' TV I did, I really, really enjoyed. And also I'm really chuffed that I've still got a career at 52. Because it's not always easy in this field, you know. And there's so many brilliant people on radio and television. So I'm always very grateful to still be here, still doing it. You know, that could end at any moment. This could be the last interview I ever did. That could be cancelled immediately. But I think, yeah, I'm so grateful. And I've been really grateful for the people I've got to work with along the way, because we're on the air. But behind us is always an amazing team, you know, my producers and my prod squad who work so hard around us. And I have to thank my kids as well, because my kids have always been very much, yeah, go on then, Mum, where are you going now? Oh, okay, you can't do the school run in the mornings because you're on the radio. So I'm very proud of them for coping with that as well. Although yesterday I very much embarrassed my daughter, because I was talking about how she taught me the lyrics to a Wet Legs song this weekend. And I had no idea that the two lines I decided to repeat on the air were actually a euphemism for something that apparently is quite untoward. It's something about buttered muffins. No idea. No idea, Josh. My daughter texted me saying, Mum, stop now. And I looked through and my whole crew looking at me going, don't talk about buttered muffins. I had no idea. So I'm very grateful to still be doing it. And if I had to retire tomorrow, I'd be very happy. I don't know what I would do, Josh, if I retired. I'd have to get a proper job, which is a terrifying prospect.
So have you ever interviewed someone that has really scared or frightened you?
You know, everyone has been lovely. But Madonna was very tricky. Only one. My whole career. She didn't want to be there. We'd waited 2 hours for her. And she was very, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. And it was sort of, oh, it's the one time I wish I'd said, look, do you know what? You clearly don't want to do this. So I'll poodle off. But she's the only one. I have to say, you know, and often you interview people who sometimes people might say, oh, they might be a bit tricky. Is that my battery? Are you back? Are you there? You're there. But I think if you're prepared and you know your stuff, which you definitely do. I think if you're learning about, you know, watching the films, doing the research, learning about people, and always having something to open the conversation with can really, really help. And trying to make people feel relaxed, because that's the thing that always surprises me, is actors and musicians are often really nervous to be interviewed because it's not their favourite thing. Their favourite thing is to make music or to act. And sometimes when they have to talk about those things and they're in a strange environment, and sometimes they're waiting for someone to maybe give them a hard time or try to get a quote off them for the papers or something, they can be a little bit on edge. So I think it's that thing of making people feel really relaxed, which is something you're brilliant at. And you do your research really well. So, yeah. So Madonna's the only one who, you know, was a bit tricky. Maybe another time.
And then finally, what's next for Zoe Ball?
Well, what's next for me? Breakfast show. There is another little job that is sort of on the horizon, possibly, but I haven't signed on the dotted line. But it may involve singing and dancing, not me singing or dancing, and it may involve being in Greece, the place, not the musical. But yes, fingers crossed, coming soon. That's all I can say on the matter.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much to our wonderful guest for being the subject of another Beyond the Title episode. If you like this, why not browse the website and see if there's anything else you like? We're now on Spotify, iTunes, YouTube, SoundCloud, Apple Music and Amazon Music. Everywhere, quite frankly. Don't forget to like our Facebook page to receive updates on forthcoming interviews, and please do give this podcast a little share. Not in a shoop-shoop song kind of way, you understand, although that's probably quite welcome. Thanks again. Hopefully see you next time. From all of us here, goodbye.